Some of you didn't experience last time, and so you maybe you'll come back tomorrow. Anyway, I thought I would begin with a little review. I decided my blackboard technique is just not up to this, so I'll begin with a little review, then I shall have a few transparencies, and then I'll go back to this gadget. Okay. So we have to, I have to get some file up here. This is working nicely, I would have to say. So that'll go away. Okay. So I said I wanted to study or talk about metastable systems, and I said I had three metastable systems I like to talk about, and the first of these was the world's simplest magnet. There it is, a single domain magnetic particle. And this red curve here describes the curve of minimum energy as the magnetization as a function of the applied field H. And if we're unloading it from a large field in the direction of the arrow, when the field, if the magnetization, you remember, is constant magnitude, so it goes down to one, then it drops and goes back. If you go back, it goes up like this. But that's not what happens. What happens in any magnet is it dribbles over to here and then falls and goes back and then goes up. There's hysteresis in this picture. So the system is not always at minimum energy. Since it's not always at minimum energy but is not wildly jumping around, it's metastable somehow. And the question is, what is that metastable? So you might have an ensemble of small domains as well, and then it would look like this, but it still is the same loading. It has one loading and a loading-unloading curve. And so I said we know how to solve that problem because we could write down the magnetic energy, and there it is. And then when the field is decreasing, this value of magnetization, say mu zero, which I took to be 1-0, is a stable local minimum until a certain critical value of the field. And if H is increasing, then the magnetization minus mu zero is a stable local minimum until the critical, and so until a certain critical field. So here are these magnetic particle ideas. And I said, in order to understand why this 1D, one-dimensional picture works, let's consider these magnetic particles, many particles, statistically homogeneous, and we'll look for their distribution. So now you see we are engaging in a sort of classical multiscale analysis. We have dropped the scale, and we're doing some kind of multiscale analysis. And I said, well, that's really the same as considering here a potential, some parameter. You look for the density. You determine the density by minimizing this energy, which involves some entropy, subject to the constraint that this is a density. So integral is 1. And that's the same as solving this differential equation, or it's the same as you know, this. They're all the same. And x equals 0 becomes a critical point of this potential as a function of lambda, as lambda tends to 0. So you can write the potential in this way. Remember, the derivative at 0 is always 0. And then what we find is that the variance of this distribution becomes infinite as lambda tends to 0. There are the pictures. It's exactly the same as the variance of the fundamental solution of the heat equation becoming infinite as time tends to infinity. Lambda is just 1 over time. This diverges. And it says that long-range fluctuations destabilize the system, which is called critical, which is very analogous to the elementary argument for critical opalescence. And now I said this may not actually be what it... This is pretty much what happens in the magnet. You may argue the reasonableness of describing this, attempting to describe a magnet in this fashion, but what is undisputable is that this is precisely what happens when you try to compute a magnetic configuration. As the well about the minimum becomes shallower and shallower, your search is permitted to take longer and longer excursions, and thus will become unstable. So this is exactly this. And so the challenge I wanted to discuss was, can we explain kinetics from this? And I gave an argument, so this is just a review, I gave an argument about how if we have a function and we want to analyze the values of this function, and we want to do that by sampling it and making histograms, and then looking at the occupation numbers in these histograms, which is the only thing we can see, we end up with a functional which is just like the functional we had before. And so now what I say is, suppose we believe, and so now here is what I was trying to say at the end. Suppose we believe the kinetics are of this system we're looking at, like a magnet, are given by a rate equation or a driving force equation. That's the simplest possible type of dynamics you could possibly impute to any system. And then, so that would be just an equation, dx dt equals minus c prime of x, or given xk minus 1, determine xk by this Euler, forward Euler, 1 over tau x minus xk minus 1 equals minus c prime of x, or which is the same thing as minimizing 1 over 2 tau x minus xk minus 1 squared plus c of x equals minimum. So now what I do is I consider an ensemble xk minus 1 i's, an ensemble of xk minus 1's, that can the first histogram up here with occupation numbers n star, and a second ensemble, the next step, xkj's, with ensemble xk with the new occupation numbers n. And then my samples will be what looks like this expression here, just 1 over 2 tau xkj minus xk minus 1 I squared plus c of xkj sort of sample values. You notice I am increasing the complexity of the notation as we get closer and closer to stochastic analysis, because in stochastic analysis, that is perhaps the most stochastic part of it, this huge amount of notation that covers every letter. And now we have pairs of histograms and an energy associated to the occupation numbers of those histograms, which I've normalized by the system size. N star over the length of N, N over N, that's F, is just the sum of these guys plus the old energy. But this is just a Monge mass transfer problem of moving one histogram to another, minimizing the cost, presumably. And let me go back to that just one second, because I wondered if I made this remark or not. You see, when you go from this histogram to this histogram by simply going from one collection of occupations to another collection of occupation numbers according to probabilities determined by a function like this, this is just a Markov chain. It's just a Markov chain. From the first guy, you go to the next guy. You remember where you were. You take the balls off and you put them back. But you don't need any further memory. And in particular, you're not doing anything to destroy the Markovianness of this by minimizing, choosing something special, by destroying the sample. So this is just a Markov chain. So the idea then is that instead of looking for the most likely minimum, we're now just looking for the most likely realization of a Markov chain. Okay? So we're now just looking for the most likely realization of a Markov chain. So if the first guys now tend to a distribution rho star, and the previous guys, and the successors tend to a distribution rho, this new term, I claim, tends to what we call the Wasserstein metric, which is given exactly in this form. The distance between rho and rho star, the new and the old squared, it's just the integral of this cost function, x minus y squared, that comes from there, dp of x and y, integrated over here. I've just chosen the unit interval, where p is a joint distribution. It's a joint distribution for rho and rho star. So the Wasserstein metric is the minimum of all these guys. And what I want to Before I go to the next line, I just want to say that the cost function is exactly a consequence of the statement that the microscopic system just moves by some elementary driving force. It's just exactly that. The simplest thing we can think of. And so we obtain, in this way, ineluctably, the Wasserstein metric. So that, and now the idea was the same, to find the stationary solution of some equilibrium ensemble as it is to do this. So the statement then I'm trying to make is that the first statement at this point is that equilibrium and non-equilibrium statistical mechanics are really the same thing if you just look at the right ensemble and do it right. Okay. Now, unfortunately, I have to say this isn't quite rigorous, so maybe I didn't do it right. But anyway, that's the case. And the second thing is that this becomes a metric for the weak star topology. We'll talk about that a little bit. And so the weak star topology represent us with the dynamics of the system. Okay. So, now, this minimum has a solution, phi of x. It can be given as phi of x times rho of x dx. Phi of x times rho of x, the integral x minus phi, and where phi is some increasing function. Here we're just doing one dimension. It's a homeomorphism of the line into itself is what it is. And phi is the Monge-Kantorovich transfer function. So the Monge-Kantorovich mass transfer problem is what emerges here, and D, I said, is a metric on the weak star topology. And here's a long list of names of eminent people who have worked on this problem. Okay, so the distribution function of the system is governed by this energy, E, which is the integral of C rho dx plus sigma times the integral of rho log rho dx. And using the Wasserstein idea, we have a gradient flow for this energy given by an implicit scheme, just as when you realize the Markov chain, you're going from place to place, step to step. So now when we take these limits, we're going from distribution to distribution. And this is the implicit scheme. Given rho k minus 1, determine rho k such that the distance, the Wasserstein distance, scaled by the same old time step, a d of rho k minus 1 squared plus the energy of rho tends to minimum. So this is moving one histogram to the next. And again, this is a weak topology metric. And now here's the magic fact, that these rho k's, after we scale them, meaning you adjust the time parameter is all you're doing, these converge to a solution of our favorite equation, the Fokker-Planck equation, which is just a linear version of the equation which Henri has been discussing. And I don't have to go even beyond that. So that everything Henri said applies to our case, except it's easier. And so it's just the Fokker-Planck equation. So this, in other words, this is variational principle gives rise to the Fokker-Planck equation. And there are some advantages here. It has a natural statistical interpretation involving iterative mappings of histograms. Iteratively changing the histograms relative to this psi with a cost function corresponds to this Markov chain whose dynamics converge to a Wasserstein metric governed process. It delivers a topology for the system, and this is what we need if we want to know what a metastable system is doing. So there's an idea about metastability where people say a system is metastable if it hangs around somewhere for a long time before getting to equilibrium. But it's a more general thing than that. What does it mean to hang around somewhere for a long time? Where are you? Are you in the back of the room? Are you in downtown Vancouver? Are you in downtown Washington? Are you at the Sun? Where and are you just there, or are you fluctuating back and forth? And just where are you? And so you need a metric. You need to know what topology you're in. And this is, so here comes a little sermon, this is what mathematics can do, you see. Our colleagues elsewhere will not understand that there is some functional structure in the problem, because they stop taking mathematics after the second or third year, you see. They don't know that. So you can really help them if you can convince them that this can offer them something, and I've tried to show you that it does. Okay. Now, I want to show you a few things about this Wasserstein metric in the next 15 minutes, because in one dimension, it's very easy to get your hands on it. Okay. So in one dimension, we can get our hands on this creature. So the transfer function, I hope you can see it. See, I can't write very well. I'm not so skilled here. I can't write the integral from 0 to phi of x, but that's what it is. So the transfer function is characterized in this fashion in one dimension, that the integral from 0 to phi of x of rho star dy is the same as the integral of 0 to x of rho dx. It's just this is simply the statement that it preserves the measure, which is one characteristic of the transfer function. In 1D, that uniquely determines it. Because we now differentiate both sides with respect to x, we obtain that the derivative of phi prime of x is rho over rho star of phi of x, or if we set f and f star to be the distribution functions of rho and rho star, phi of x is just f star inverse of f of x. So Walkington and I discovered this, and then Richard Jordan, who I worked with, I didn't give any bibliographic citations, but the result about the Fokker-Planck equation is a result of Felix Otto and Richard Jordan and myself. And Jordan pointed out that our little calculation here was known to Fréchet. So it's interesting now to... So it was known to Fréchet, but when was it known to Fréchet? In the mid-50s. So, I mean, Fréchet lived a long time, but actually it was probably known to Paul Levy, because the article where Fréchet talks about it, he is working on a problem of Paul Levy. So it's really a classical fact, and the reason is in one dimension, the mere mass transfer property alone uniquely classifies the Monge transfer function without having to minimize it. So in fact, it's the same function regardless of the cost function. It's the same transfer. Okay, so now I just want to show you. So you see, this means, now I want to show you, I said it's a weak star topology metric. So I just want to show you. So here's how you can use that. So if you have a sequence of densities which converge weak star to rho n, converging weak star to rho, and they're positive, say, then their distribution functions converge pointwise, and so do their inverses. And therefore, the functions phi n of x, which are given by this formula, fn inverse of f of x, converge to x pointwise, and therefore this integral, d of rho n rho squared, times the integral over x minus over omega of x minus phi n of x squared rho dx, this converges to zero, you see, just by elementary.
Doesn't that assume that you don't have any atoms?
Pardon?
Excuse me. Doesn't that assume that you don't have atoms in the measure?
Rho is a density. It's not the measure. Excuse me. Rho is the density. Then you have to generalize this whole thing to get the whole result, right? Vice versa. So, therefore, weak convergence implies convergence of the Wasserstein metric. This is actually the hard step in any general proof. This is the hard, and all the proofs, the more general proof I know, always relies on solving the Monge-Kantorovich mass transfer problem, which, as you see, in one dimension is easy to do. And so this is not a completely trivial fact. But the next fact is, you see, if the metric tends to zero, then you simply take a smooth function, and then you see the integral of zeta rho n dy minus zeta rho dx, that's just the double integral of zeta of y minus zeta of x dpn of x and y, where pn is the minimizing measure. You don't have to know that there's a solution to a Monge transfer problem. You always know there's a minimizing measure. And therefore, you can estimate the absolute value by just the double integral of zeta prime of y times x minus y dx, just by the mean value theorem. And that's, by Schwartz, just less than the Wasserstein metric times some constant, which depends on zeta prime. So, in other words, So that if the Wasserstein metric tends to zero, then certainly on smooth functions, rho n converges weakly to rho, and therefore for all functions. So this shows that D is a metric for the weak star topology. Now, what I would like to do is do one or two more examples of the same thing, which I will need later. Well, I don't. I will like to need them later, but I need worse stuff later. And then we'll go back to more more fun. And so recall here that should I focus this? So he's got 30. So if we have two probability measures, then we have joint distribution, which we just said. We have an optimal measure, and we also can characterize this by the solution of the Monge-Kantorovich transfer problem. In one dimension, we have a special way of doing this, namely, because the integral from zero to phi of rho star is the integral from zero, just what we did. We had our iterative implicit scheme, which gives rise to the Fokker-Planck equation. And now the example I'd like to do involves transport. So, in fact, you see, and there are a number of ways to describe transport, and in particular, Brenier has some characterizations. There are some characterizations of the Monge-Kantorovich mass transfer function in terms of transport, which you can find in his. Brenier and Benamou, for example, they treat this numerically. And so in this simple transport equation, d rho dt equals ddx b rho, let's suppose that b is the derivative of a potential c. B equals c prime, and the potential looks like this. And here's a special point a. And b of 0 equals b of 1 equals 0. So if rho, say, satisfies this equation, then just by integrating, you see, the ddt of the integral of rho is 0. So if rho 0 is a probability measure, the initial data is a probability measure, we still have a family of probability measures. So this is a property we want. Now we can solve that by characteristics. Cheap way to solve. There are different ways. Here's my cheap way of solving this by characteristics. You see, B only depends on x. Normally, you expand this, and then you have a complicated characteristic family to find. But since B only depends on x, just multiply everything by B, and then we have a function B rho. B rho t equals B times B rho x. And so I just have to solve ft equals B fx, determine the characteristic c equals phi of x and t. And I know that, actually, I don't know if there, I hope there are still some students left here who maybe don't know this or have forgotten it since the final. And here is the characteristic. If G is phi inverse, then F of X equals F0 of G of X and T is the solution, and rho of X and T can of F and rho you can calculate this way, so we can calculate this explicitly. Now let's go back to the Wasserstein. So the transfer function, as we've noticed now, we're noticing now for the third time, satisfies the integral from 0 to phi hat, I'm calling the transfer function, of rho of x prime and t dx prime is the integral from 0 to x of rho 0 of x prime dx prime. And now I'm going to differentiate that with respect to time. Am I running too slowly or too fast? Nobody's up. So if you differentiate this, then we have your phi t rho of phi hat, and t is the integral from 0 to phi hat of rho t. So that's the first term plus the integral of 0 to have b rho x prime dx prime. Recall that b of 0 is 0. And then we have here that 0 is equal to phi hat t plus b times rho. Rho is not 0, so phi hat t is minus b of phi hat. In other words, the transfer function is a solution of the characteristic equation with the right data, and therefore it is the solution of the characteristic. So in other words, for transport, for elementary transport, the solution of the characteristic equation is the Monge transfer function. This is the Monge transfer function. So, in other words, the distance between rho zero and rho squared is the same as the integral of x minus phi of x prime and t squared times rho zero dx. And this has consequences. So, for example, for the potential which we were looking at, yes, it's decreasing and then increasing. So all the directions are toward this point A. The characteristic tends to A as t tends to infinity, and it's easy to see that the densities rho star converge to Dirac mass. Everything gets pushed to the bottom of the well. Everything is pushed to the bottom of the well. This is what transport does. It pushes things to the bottom of wells. And therefore, the Wasserstein metric between rho zero and the Dirac at A squared is just the integral of x minus a squared times rho zero dx. That's all it is. Now, I'd say we can use this and its variance in many situations. There are a lot of things you can do with this type of analysis. It's not so easy in general, of course, but that's possible. And you know these explicit things. Now, here's another example, more in line with your question. Suppose you have, here we have two convex combinations of Dirac masses, but they both have the same points, A1 and A2, where they're concentrated. Okay, mu1 delta A1 plus mu2 delta A2, and mu star mu1 star delta A1 plus mu2 star delta A2, and they're both probability masses, then you can check. So this is an exercise that the Wasserstein metric squared is just A1 minus A2 squared times mu1 minus mu1 star. Or, remember, mu1 plus mu2, mu1 plus mu2 is 1, so it doesn't matter if you use mu1, the 1s or the 2s are averages. So you have this. Notice this is linear. The square of the metric is linear in the weights, so that the Wasserstein looks like a Helder 1/2 metric, you see. It's not differentiable, patently differentiable by itself. So all these statements about finding equilibrium equations based on iterative principles and doing this and doing that and making estimates and so on, they're not straightforward. Okay. Now let's see if I can keep going here. End of slideshow. Get rid of this one. And now we go, now it's time in the next 10 minutes. Let's have some fun here. Okay, this is where we were. And what I want to begin talking about now, and this will be now to the end of next lecture, is diffusion-mediated transport and the Markov chain paradigm for the Brownian ratchet. So this is going to be, I think, for me and Mike Kowalczyk, so this is joint work with Michael Kowalczyk, is a beautiful example of these ideas, as you will see, ultimately. So remember, we showed this movie so this is presumably a little proton motor. And this is not protein motors because it's a huge scale. It is the track, these tracks here, much bigger than that, because this is 50 nanometers and this is 20 microns, one of these tracks. So you can calculate for yourself what that scale is.
Which is the motor? What's the yellow line?
The yellow line points to the motor. What is probably the motor? It says here, Hirakawa says here, quick freeze deep etch electron micrograph of mouse axon, a membranous organelle conveyed by fast transport. That's the membranous organelle, this whole business problem, is linked with a microtubule, well, or something is, by a short cross bridge arrow. Here's the short cross bridge, which could be a motor molecule. You see, could be a motorbike, and that's frozen, of course. Okay, so here now I want to talk a little bit about diffusion-mediated transport. So this is my one of my primary goals in these lectures is to make, well, I'd like to say some things about this. So this is again not exactly. It's about metastability, it is. So, let me tell you about this. So, Feynman in 1966, so this is how people know about it, but it's really not the right thing. But you see, Feynman in 1966 wrote gave a few lectures and then wrote a few papers called There's Plenty of Room at the Bottom. And this is cited by physicists as being sort of perhaps one of the origins of interest in nanoscale phenomena. Of course, they have their own way of looking at things, as you see. And one of the things he discussed was the possibility of a ratchet and pawl device powered by fluctuation. So it's exactly this. Here is a heat bath with this fan-like gadget, and molecules hit this heat bath. And so heat these fan, and so it kind of flips around. And it flips equally in one direction or the other. It flips equally in both directions, you see. I'm looking at that fan apparatus head on. It equally in one direction or the other. But at the end, and then it turns this rod, and at the end with a flywheel on it, maybe to give it a little momentum, maybe, hopefully. And at the end, though, you see these teeth are weirdly shaped so that it's easier for this ball to lock it, to make the ratchet, if the thing is spinning counterclockwise than if it's spinning clockwise, or vice versa, depending on how you're looking at that picture. And it's hooked to a spring here. But then, you see, you can make this move around. You can make this move around in one direction, mostly. Mostly in one direction, so you can get work from these fluctuations. And Feynman concluded that this was impossible. Actually, if you isolate the system and analyze everything very carefully, you find that you will not get any work out of these fluctuations, which, of course, is the natural thing. If you could get work out of fluctuations, where would we be? We'd have boiled away a long time ago. In the meantime, Huxley, in 1957, the same Huxley we have heard about, offered an extensive analysis for myosin as a motor responsible for muscle activity. And so, namely, I just want to tell you, point out, yes, I can do that. If I take this and set this over here, it will sit there in equilibrium, metastable from Earth scale, but equilibrium from our point of view forever and nothing. If I hold my arm up here, or you hold your arm up here, after a while, it gets tired, right? Okay, so something's doing work. What? And it's muscle myosin. And we're not going to talk about muscle myosin, but it's a molecular motor, similar to the ones I want to discuss. And it does not violate any thermodynamical principles. It works in perfect accord with thermodynamics because energy is being supplied. And here, in fact, is another example of the same energy. So Vail, in 1986, proposed kinesin molecular motors as responsible for intracellular transport and analogs of it in eukarya. And it's powered by one of the famous biological motor reactions, the adenosine triphosphate hydrolysis reaction, where adenosine triphosphate is hydrolyzed to adenosine diphosphate and inorganic phosphorus. So you might think, and indeed, we did think, people did think, who thought about it, that inside the cell, when something has to go from, say, the nucleus to a far end, or when certain nutrients or other things, that's when things have to be moved around inside the cell, that they diffuse. But you saw in the very first picture how crowded it was near that little tiny thing, which was probably the motor, yes. You saw how crowded that was. And what is the time period for cellular transport? It's for diffusion. It's rather long. Remember how big these things are. A cell is maybe some microns, 100 microns or something. So there is another mechanism. It's not by diffusion. It's by motors. It's by motors, okay? So how do we think about diffusion? So we can think about diffusion microscopically as paths of a stochastic process. Here are some paths of a stochastic process. They can be fast or slow. Or we can think of it as a drop diffusing macroscopically. It can be fast or slow, but mathematically, one of the main difficulties, and this is something that Henri has, although I don't think he's verbalized, he certainly attacked this all through his lectures, is that it's very difficult to separate scales in diffusion, and sometimes not really possible. So you have to somehow grab this problem in some way. Diffusion itself is isotropic even in the presence of a potential well. Things just move to their Gibbs distribution. That's the other feature of diffusion. Okay, now I want to go back here. So diffusion-mediated transport, I said, is a prominent feature of molecular-level transduction processes in the family of eukarya. And I don't know if the family of eukarya is a recent family. I found an interesting book about this. It's not germane. I will shut up. Okay. And so there are three main families, the kinesins, the dynines, and, well, there's really two main families, kinesins and myosin. There's also dynein. And they're also rotary motors. There's a lot of work on this. This is not something we're just doing the first stuff on. So during Ehrmantraut, Oster, and Peskin, and other work, subsequent work by Oster and Peskin, this is the main work which you would call mathematical. There is modeling by Ajari, Prost, and Dulacre. Presumably Ajari and Prost were the first to discuss the idea of diffusion-mediated transport, but perhaps it was Estumian and Nesmaniasko too. They were not discovered. Of course, as I said, Vail discovered these. Vail and his group seem to have been the first to have actually discovered motor proteins inside cells. I point out to you that in the 500 million lifespan of eukarya on the planet, this was discovered about 15 years ago. So it's a very recent idea. And there's an immense biophysics literature and a much more immense biochemistry literature and molecular biology literature. Details of mechanisms are becoming available. And there are some groups that are attempting to use these motors for things other than for what they were designed, which is not trivial. But if you're not asking much, maybe you won't get much. There are other examples of what I would call diffusion-mediated transport, and the one which motivated us, in fact, was the so-called Janusy effect in liquid crystals studied by Kosa E, that's Wayne N. E., whom you know, and Pafi Mohore, these guys are liquid crystal physicists. It's a light-actuated dynamatic interaction. There are other examples. Electron-lipid tunneling, lipid bilayers, charged particles moving over, interdigitated electrodes. Now, that example, I think, was constructed in order to show that the mechanism can work. And there are some surprises, and I'll wait. You'll have to wait for that. The quantitative studies have focused on modeling the system at the mesoscale level, but there is also extensive stochastic modeling. So here is a sketch of a protein motor. This is actually a sketch of the assay of the elementary assays used. So the first one we've seen one picture of already, and I'll show you another one. You put the motors on a glass plate, and you drop the tracks on top. If the tracks move, you've found a motor. Okay. The second one is the inverse experiment. You have the tracks lying on the plate, and you put the motors on top. Of course, you can't see them. So what you do is you take styrofoam beads or something which will fluoresce or something, and you dip that in a pool of motors and then drop the beads on top. I'll show you some pictures. Then The suggested mechanisms, of course, involve very complicated chemistry and conformational changes. You don't even think about trying to describe in detail the mechanics of what is happening during one of these processes, because nobody has too clear an idea. Even though we think of it mechanistically, it's not completely a mechanistic process. There's a lot of randomness in it. And in very little, you just read one of those biology papers and you'll see. The simplest mechanism at the stochastic level simply consists of interchange of a hydrolyzation and transport step, which you can think of as just being an Itô diffusion or a Langevin equation, and relaxation and diffusion, which you can just think of being diffusion. The switch between the two can be deterministic, or it can be random. If it's random, there are criteria you have to place on the switching time in order that you obtain some.
What do you mean by switching? Having the first process for something?
Yes, that's right. A good point. What do I mean? So, I'm saying that this what is happening in this system is not a single thing. Two things are happening. There is a hydrolyzation and transport step where the molecule it hydrolyzes ATP and moves in a certain interval. And there's a second step when it waits. And while it's waiting, it's just diffusing. It may be bound, mostly bound, it may be weakly bound or strongly bound even to the microtubule, but it's just diffusing. So there are two things happening in this system, and the system is switching from one to the other and back again. For an individual motor, as it receives or collects an ATP molecule or waits for one, you see. And during the hydrolyzation step, of course, it cannot accept other ones. And there may be characteristic times for this, and that's what determines the switching. So here is a second movie from Professor Hiratsuka. Here he's got these tracks running around in circles. He has some running around a big circle above and another's running around in a smaller circle. So this is a little leitmotif which we'll run through here as he improves what he can make these guys do. You see, if they can run around in circles, you can make them. They're not, obviously, there's some not doing what they're supposed to. And this one, let's see if I can get this one to work. So this one I got off the web, I think it's from the Endow lab. And these are the styrofoam balls. There they go. They're wiggling around, you see. They're wiggling around. Every once in a while you see one fly through.
What's the time scale?
That's real timing. It's probably close to real time. But there are so many of these guys on the... There are so many of these guys on the styrofoam ball, it's not a realistic time. I'll tell you what a realistic time is. They travel on the plate about 1 micron a second. To understand that, keep in mind that, say, it's 50 nanometers across. So you figure out how fast that is. I'll tell you. It's approximately 40 times your stride every second. That's what it is. So how fast are you going if you're going 40 times your stride every second? So... This is about where I would like to stop. I'll just tell you what the test problem is. So we want to study this in terms of the probability densities. And so we'll discuss a system where we exchange a potential diffusion in a potential with diffusion. And just to point out here, you see, so here is a typical potential, a two-tooth potential. So this problem comes from Estumian. If we diffuse only in the potential alone, then this red line is its Gibbs distribution. And if we diffuse just by itself, then some blue line like that is its Gibbs distribution. So you expect the solution to oscillate between the two Gibbs distributions, providing some type of transport if it works. But this is not transport. It's also not the solution. Let's see. So here, I'll stop. I won't show you what the answer is, but we'll stop. We can stop here, and next time we'll complete this discussion. So we have now this. Let me say, but before we stop, I'll tell you. But since we're oscillating between these two equations, you see, we're not really close to these Gibbs guys, and so. What this means is that this system is very far from equilibrium. It's kind of metastable. It's always doing the same thing back and forth. But it's very far from equilibrium. Okay. That's all. Yes, sir.
Is there any connection between this mechanism and stochastic resonance?
Yeah.
So how do you relate?
It's not a real strong connection, I think, but there is definitely a connection. But it's technical to say what that means. But you'll see. It's the inverse of stochastic. It turns out to be the opposite of stochastic resonance. Because stochastic resonance is something which happens sometimes. This is something, turns out to be something which happens almost all the time. Even though it's far from equilibrium.
The stochastic differential equation is well before. You see that the switch could be. How do you model the fact that it switches? Is it natural to modulate it, for instance, saying that you have a stochastic in time?
Right. You could model it that which is Poisson distributed about, which is Poisson distributed about a certain thing. Then when you go press to the distribution function, you end up with the same thing. There are other people who think that you actually should take the two PDEs,
right,
and switch them stochastically, which would be something differently. You could do that,
right.
I think. But I have to confess, I rebel intuitively when faced with that. Maybe you do too, because the mixing of the scales is so huge, right?
So what is the outcome of the explanation by Feynman of the impossibility of the quantum logic?
Well, of course, I think Feynman is quite correct. But you see, there's the ideas you are not obtaining. You are not. It is fluctuation-driven transport, but it's not in violation of the second law of thermodynamics because you are not attempting to drain a heat bath. You're pushing stuff into it all the time. You see, and the ATP reaction, the adenosine triphosphate reaction, of course, is providing energy to the system.
Okay, so it's because it's providing energy,
yeah,
that it can happen.
Right, right. You're kicking. We're kicking it constantly.
So
kicking it.
Still does not exist.
No, I think there's no. I don't think there's much debate about that anymore. It may be at some other physical level, but I think that there have been many analyses of those.
Thank you. Okay, so thank you again, David.